around in this great big city. Fast money and the life will never show you no pity. Oh, I work hard trying to make my bones, but times have changed and I just got to move on. Can't run away, I can't run away, I can't run. I can't run away, I can't run away from the things that I've done.
Good evening and welcome to We Know a Guy Radio, a production of Bear Media Consultants. This is where we talk about everything from organized crime to entertainment. Guests will include former mobsters and retired lawmen, entertainers, writers, reporters, men and women. You can participate in tonight's show through our chat room or by calling in at 646-478-0982. My name is Denny Griffin, retired investigator and true crime author. Our producer, Kim Colton, is manning the switchboard. And I'm happy to be joined by my co-host, former Gambino crime family associate and author, Andrew DiDonato. Andrew.
How you doing tonight, Dennis?
Good, good. Glad to have you on with us.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
On the evening of June 2nd, 1981, two people were found shot to death in the living room of an apartment at the rear of the PM Pub, located at 238 West Rand Road in Lakemore, Illinois, a community that is about 45 miles northwest of Chicago. The victims were the tavern's owner, 37-year-old Ronald Scharf, and barmaid Patricia Freeman. Joining us tonight to talk about those killings and their aftermath are Paul Scharf, son of victim Ronald Scharf, and Keith Bettinger, retired Long Island police officer turned author. Keith and Paul have a book in progress with the working title of Murders in McHenry County, A Son's Quest for Justice. Keith and Paul, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Dennis. Hi, Denny, how are you?
Good, Keith.
How are you guys doing tonight?
I'm doing really good. I'm glad to be here.
It's beautiful and sunny out here in Las Vegas while we're doing it. You ought to come back, Denny.
Won't be long, about halfway through. I wanted to start tonight, if we can, talking about the murders. I just described them briefly here. Paul, would you want to take over and tell us about June 2nd, 1981?
Sure, absolutely. June 2nd, 1981, my father was killed in the back of his bar with his barmaid, Patricia Freeman. This murder went unsolved for many, many years. I have a very ambitious former babysitter whose father was my father's best friend. And on a road trip, taking Jim Hager, and it's Holly Hager, my former babysitter, taking Jim home back to Arkansas, Holly asked Jim, "No, who do you think killed Ron, my father?" And he mentioned Glenn, who was Patricia Freeman's former boyfriend at the time, or ex-boyfriend at the time, and he also mentioned somebody called Larry Newman. And Holly went, when she got home, she started Googling Larry Newman. And what she found was Larry Newman on a serial killer site and saw that he was from McHenry. She continued to Google more, and she found a book, Pallada. It was a book about a former Chicago outfit, Frank Pallada, who, if you're familiar with the movie Casino, the movie Casino was based on a man named Tony Spilotro, played by Joe Pesci in that movie. Well, that was Frank Collada's boss. Frank headed up a gang called the Hole in the Wall Gang. They were named the Hole in the Wall Gang because back then, when alarm systems are not as sophisticated as they are today as far as motion detectors and whatnot, they would put things around the window and the doors. So what this gang would do is punch through walls, punch through ceilings to get inside. And Holly started reading that book. She ordered the book, and on page 130, it outlined my father's murder. So immediately what she did was printed off a bunch of things that she found off the internet relating to Larry Newman, grabbed the book, and mailed it to her father. Jim had read everything, and he gave me a call. We were making what I thought was small talk, and we were talking for about 15 minutes. And Jim, he's a biker. He's not one for small talk, so I was kind of taken by it a little bit. And then he asked me, "Hey, you know who killed your father, right?" And I said, "Well, if it was in today's paper, I missed it. Tell me." And he said, "Larry Newman." And then he started bringing up Frank Collada, Tony Spilotro, and I'm just in absolute awe of this information. And he started explaining to me, I'm trying to take all this information in, trying to take in the names. And what I wound up doing was getting the book Collada myself, and I verified that this indeed was my father's murder. So what I did was I got a hold of Huntington Press to go ahead and to let them know that hey, there's a book out here about my father's murder that's currently unsolved. And I went ahead and I forwarded an email, and they forwarded it on to the author. The author happened to be Dennis Griffin. And from there, we started corresponding, and Denny had asked me if I was interested in getting my father's case resolved and solved. And, of course, that I would. And that kind of became a quest to go ahead and get my father's case reopened and looked at. And with a little bit of campaigning, a little bit of pressure, we were able to go ahead and have Larry Newman named as the murderer of my father and Patricia Freeman under what's called exceptional status. Exceptional status is in circumstances where the murderer is either in prison and serving life and will not get out, or has died. And there was another reason I can't think of it. Well, Larry Newman was in prison, and he died in prison in 2007. So that's a little bit about where we stand today.
Yeah, it was when I got that email that was contact that you made with Huntington Press. It was, when Frank and I were writing his book, and I remembered that portion of it, it never dawned on me that was an unsolved homicide. And so
right.
When I got the contact, I said to myself, you got to be kidding me. It was 20-some years old. And because Frank told me that he turned all the information he had, not just about your dad's case and Patricia Freeman, but under the witness protection agreement, he had to tell everything he knew about anything and everybody. And,
correct.
They had met with people from McHenry County and so forth, so it just never dawned on me that case was still, basically a cold case homicide at that time. So it was really quite a thing, and thank goodness that that Holly Hager, your former babysitter, was that attentive.
That's exactly right. I mean, she's earned the nickname or the title Nancy Drew, because she's definitely earned it, and she was definitely scrappy about it. She started going to the library, pulling up all news articles and stuff, and in doing so, she was kind of surprised by how little information was out there at the time back in 1981. Lakemore is a small community, part of McHenry County, part of McHenry in an unincorporated area. So this, when this occurred, this was a big news story, and it was a shock to the whole community, because it didn't make sense. We were a small community. How does this happen? Not only one person, but two people get killed in a very purposeful way. It wasn't a robbery or anything like that. But what was interesting is how little news was being made about this. And, as we get into this further and further, what we start to believe is that, the McHenry County Sheriff's Department, or Lieutenant George Hendel, who was the chief investigator at the time, had to be either absolutely derelict or arrogant or on the take. I mean, I don't think there's really another category that you can come to the conclusion about this.
No, I was just going to ask you that. I was definitely going to just ask you that. I was saying that Frank profited this during his sessions with the government when he was in witness program. That was my next question to you. Like, whatever happened? Like, did they ever take up an investigation? You're saying he was notified. So that's definitely questionable for sure.
Well, what happened was the FBI did contact McHenry County, and they did fly out to San Diego. That's where Frank was in jail at that time, and he was with the FBI with a government witness protection program. And we don't recall who it may have been, but it was a police type and a DA type that had it out there. And basically what Frank told them, they said that they didn't find that credible, that they found Glenn to be more credible. When you reflect back, that's really hard to imagine because, you know, Larry Newman was prosecuted and sent to prison for 125 years for a triple murder that he committed back in the 50s. And it so happened to be it was a bar owner, a barmaid, and a newspaper vendor outside of the bar. And he was from McHenry. He knew my father. And Jim Hager gave that name to McHenry County back in 1981. So the fact that you had a triple murder in McHenry, that should have got him on the short list. But then further, to have Frank Galata, who'd never met Jim, they didn't know each other, go ahead and give the same name, and their stories match up, just that they were, you know, half a country apart about this. And, you know, what makes things further peculiar, and, you know, and Keith, if you can pick up on this, there was a newspaper article that was written in Las Vegas after this visit, and it was by the Chicago outfit's attorney. And Keith, if you can pick up a little bit on that one.
Yeah, Paul, there was seemed to be a battle going on at the time in the 1980s between the Las Vegas Sun and the editor and publisher there and Joe Jablonski, who was the special agent in charge of the FBI office here in Las Vegas. And somehow the Sun's reporter got in touch or was contacted by an attorney from Chicago. Now, this attorney was also had it suspended from practice for a while, and he became, believe it or not, a Ouija board expert. And he gave a statement to the newspaper reporter that Frank Galata was not a credible witness, and was basically telling things that a prosecutor should be saying about some case, not what an attorney who would be handling criminal cases as the defense attorney should be saying. It was so preposterous. It was just unbelievable that this person would have this kind of knowledge. It had to be spoon-fed to him somewhere. And it looked like it was just done to discredit Frank Galata.
You know, so you have to think that, you know, what was going on as far as the McHenry folks traveling out to, you know, San Diego, you know, this stuff is all under the table. This is not public information. No charges were filed against anybody. So how was this, you know, civilian lawyer, how did he know that all this information was going on, that he had to go try to smear Frank in a newspaper campaign? You know, and the circumstances that we find ourselves is that we're riddled with all these different kinds of things that really lead you to think that the McHenry County Sheriff's Office was definitely in the pocket of the Chicago outfit. And, you know, we have that, and I know Frank and his former FBI handler, Dennis Arnoldy, you know, both felt strongly that that was probably the case.
Let me ask you this, Paul, and I want to ask Andrew to comment too, but my understanding is that in order to get in the witness protection program, you have to agree to tell the truth. If you get caught in a lie, if they catch you lying to them, the feds, you're probably not going to get in the witness protection program anything, any deal. There will be no deal. The deal would be off, and you're going to be prosecuted, and if your life has been threatened by the mob, you're also apt to end up dead. So as far as motivation for Frank to have lied, to have made this up, I mean, if it didn't happen, there was no reason to make it up because all he could do was get himself in trouble for saying
Absolutely.
Something that wasn't true. Yeah, so
Absolutely.
So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that Frank would just out of the blue say, yeah, I think I'll make up a little story about Larry Newman.
Not only that, Dennis, you know, but, you know, a lot of times, you know, this happens in a lot of organized crime cases where you've got the defense. They have to smear the witnesses because, you know, organized crime and the truth, Dennis, you know how that is. They can't survive in the same room. So smear
right.
campaigns are nothing new. You know, it goes on every day in court. It goes on every day when you got a witness coming forward, revealing sensitive information that could put a client away for a life sentence or even, you know, death penalty cases or what have you. And what people need to know is not only – you know, would they rip up your agreement upon lying upon this kind of information? But in order for you to get into that phase of the witness protection program, you also have to go through a lie detector test. So there's not just your word on it. It's the investigators from the FBI and everybody, you know, double-checking everything that you say. Not only that, but then you go for the other phase is taking a lie detector test. So... you know, what Dennis was just said, you know, it holds a lot of weight and a lot of value that, you know, Frank was on the up and up and you might have had a dead serious problem out in McHenry County that this was happening and these guys would definitely need to be looked at as far as being corrupt.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I, again, without such, strong, evidence from Frank and whatnot, the man was a triple murderer from McHenry. He knew my father. How does he not get out shortly?
Now, Dennis, let me ask you a question, Dennis. Wasn't this Larry Newman's case, wasn't he already away and then for some reason he got out for some, he was already away for murder, wasn't he? And then got out. Was that the guy?
Yes, the guy. He got the 125 years for that triple homicide in the 50s. And, well, Newman's dad supposedly had a little bit of money, and I guess we all know the reputation of Chicago and Illinois politics and so on. And he was able somehow to apparently to get his son, Larry, out on parole after about 12 years. So he only did about a 12 spot out of 100 and a quarter. And
that's not bad, he got released.
It's a hell of a deal. In fact, when he was in prison, when he was doing that time, that's where he met Frank Collada. Frank was in doing state time at that same time frame, and that's how those two got acquainted. That's how Frank got to meet him when he was doing the big stretch. And when Frank got out of prison, Newman hadn't been paroled yet, and Frank didn't really think he ever would be. I mean, when you're doing that kind of a stretch, the odds of getting out are pretty slim. But he got out and he contacted Frank and wanted to know if he could ever help Frank out or they could ever conspire in any scores or anything. So that's how Frank met him, was in prison, and then they kept in touch after Newman got this miracle parole deal. And, you know, Paula, my recollection is that according to Frank's account, Newman... well, we all know Newman was a killer, and he liked to kill. He wasn't hurting for money. He killed and stole and everything because he liked it. He wasn't forced into it by economic situations. But Newman's ex-wife was in your dad's bar, and your dad had thrown her out or asked her to leave or cut her off or something like that. And Newman, she ended up calling Larry Newman out in Vegas and complained that your dad had disrespected her, you know, by throwing her out of the bar or cutting her off or whatever the situation was. And according to Frank, Larry took that as a personal insult, that he felt that, your dad knew who her ex-husband was, so if he you know, did anything to embarrass her or whatever. It was direct Larry Newman. Now, Andrew, you've known a lot of mob type guys. Are there some guys like that would have that mentality to take an incident like that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, without a doubt. I mean, there's guys who have dreams about guys and then kill them the next day. I mean, you know, the human mind, especially when you get guys who got a propensity for violence, you know, or somebody who's got a short fuse. Sure, this happens every day. You know, guys' egos are tremendous in organized crime circles. And what happens is they think that if they don't act, that people are going to see it as a weakness. And then they feel, you know, they don't want to live with that over their head, you know, and they wouldn't be able to. Believe it or not, they wouldn't be able to sleep in some instances. You know, you sit here and you think about, here's a guy, he's on the West Coast, and he gets this phone call about an ex-wife getting thrown out of a bar, and yet he makes it personal, like it was a personal attack on himself. That shows you how big his ego was.
Yeah,
I mean, he should have. She was an ex-wife for a reason. Who goes chasing after to help ex-wives?
See, but that's just it. It wasn't about her. See, that's what guys don't understand. It's not about her. It's about him. He's figuring that anybody and anyone who lives in that county is supposed to know better because of who he thought he was. And that is perfect mindset for a guy in organized crime circles. It is perfect mindset, believe it or not. And it's a shame to say, you know, because, you know, you look at what people put in value on other people's lives and, you know, you look back upon it and you just can't, you know, just normal thinking just can't fathom that. But these guys, that's not normal for them. For them, it's normal.
Well, Larry was a very... Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just thinking, you know, what we might want to do before we go too much farther, Paul, is talk about when you decided to write a book, because I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, sure. We had a campaign, you know, as far as keeping this in the public, you know, and keeping pressure on McHenry County. I'm very familiar with my hometown. I know how McHenry works, and I was always skittish of them. Even if they weren't that administration that initially investigated it, I know that McHenry County's rough. And in my heart, I knew from the beginning that this is going to have to be something that's going to be campaigned to keep the pressure on. And that was a good choice because, you know, there was times in the investigation, they wouldn't return my phone calls. You know, they didn't want to talk to me. And, you know, through the media, started contacting them and asked them, hey, you know, why aren't you giving this guy a call? you know, they started picking up and started communicating to me again. So finally we got to the point where this case was closed by exceptional status. We didn't know what exceptional status was, so we had to, you know, look into it. And what we were able to find was Adam Walsh and John Walsh. Adam Walsh was a young boy that was viciously killed back in 1981. And John Walsh, his father, is the host of America's Most Wanted and whatnot. In Adam's case, in, I believe, 2008, was closed to his exceptional status. And that's where I learned that exceptional status means this is a way to go ahead and clear something off the books or close it. That was my understanding. So I wanted to write a book, you know, to honor my father. You know, I don't want him forgotten. I don't want his story forgotten. And so that is what I wanted to do. So me and Keith started working on that. And at some point we decided that, you know, we needed to get, you know, some more detailed information about the investigation and whatnot. So Keith filed for a Freedom of Information Act, and it was refused. And it was refused. I'm sorry?
Twice it was refused.
Yeah, twice it was refused. That's correct. And it was refused because the case was open and that there was witnesses that needed to be protected. And that kind of blew me away because that wasn't the perception of the way that I understood things. And I wasn't the only one. You know, the Sun-Times ran on the first page, Bar Slaying case closed. Northwest Herald, the McHenry County newspaper, probe into 81 death closes. So when I, you know, when we found out about this, I knew I was kind of hoodwinked, because the investigation never was a full investigation. It investigated Larry Newman. It investigated Debbie Newman. But what it didn't investigate was, what were the cops doing? What was George Hendel doing? You know, what were their involvement? And we never went there. So now where we stand is, we have this case that's closed or not closed, and it's open. You know, and unless Debbie Newman's going to go ahead and make a confession and say, "Oh, I recant everything I already told you," there's nobody to be arrested here. And when the case is open like this, I'm interested in finding out what the sheriff's department was looking into. I'm afraid if I start poking around that I could find myself in a situation to where I'm interfering with an open murder case. And I think this was done on purpose, so that they're, you know, the boys in blue protecting themselves. This way I can't look and find anything complicit about the sheriff's office with this if they were complicit. And to me, the quest for justice is transparency. And when we have things locked up, we can't get access to them, we have transparency. And Andrew Zanke, he was Lieutenant Zanke beginning this murder investigation. I don't have faith in his investigation. He was keeping his cards close to his chest. He didn't like talking to me. I had to make not talking to me worse than talking to me. Letter of notification, this is what explained the exceptional status to me. You know, it was given to me via email, in a very impersonal email, and, you know, there's your case, we're all done. And, you know, and the thing about this is, when Lieutenant George Hendel started the investigation, my father's investigation, he became Under Sheriff Hendel. And then later he became Sheriff Hendel. Well, since Andrew Zanke, he's now become from Lieutenant to Under Sheriff, and he's now thrown his hat into the sheriff's ring. And for the life of me, I just cannot deal with the fact that I'm going to make another sheriff out of my father's open murder case that really is a reverse engineered case now, because we know who the murderer was. We just need to go ahead and find out the details. And it sickens me to death that this man is going to, you know, try to become the sheriff, and the McHenry County community is supposed to trust him for their safety. And I'm telling the folks in McHenry, this is not the guy that you want.
So you were not overly impressed with not only the initial investigation by Mr. Hendel, but even the second go-around at it after Frank's book came out with Mr. Zanke. You're not impressed with either aspect of that investigation then?
No, not at all. I have to leave everything on the table. I have to keep an open mind. I don't know what was what. I wasn't there, you know. I can't help to think that, you know, Hendel, he was in the outfit's pocket. And Zanke, he's just protecting the boys in blue. You know, neither one of these are pro-victims. You know, where are the victims in this? You know, and I want the folks in McHenry to think about this. You know, I'm in a position to where I had 27 years to go ahead and absorb this and move myself from a victim to a survivor. You know, so I'm mentally a little more prepared to deal with what's going on today. But if you were to find yourself in a terrible, tragic situation of somebody close to you being murdered, this is a man that's going to be on the spot for you. And I'm telling you, he's not the guy that you want. He's not going to communicate to you. He's very cold. He's very reserved. Or at least that's what he was with me. And that's the only thing that I can tell you about him, is the way that he treated me. You know, when I did a show, a radio show in Las Vegas with Frank, and while we were driving to the show, you know, Frank looked at me, and he said, he goes, "You want to know something?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, I think McHenry County's scared of you. I'm like, scared of me? You know, and McHenry County's rough. I mean, they'll tear you up. I don't know how it is, I'm scaring them. He goes, did you say that you were going to sue him? I said, no, but if I could, I would have been well into the process already. And he goes, well, I think that you scare him. And that kind of tells it all, you know, that I don't know why they fear me, but they chose to fear me. I don't know if this means that they understand that there was complicity in the case and they're choosing to hide it. But it's just an absolute disrespect and a disregard to me, the family. You know, and I was the lead family member for both the Sharp and the Freeman's family on this. I was engaged 110% all the time, 24/7. And not talking to me was a slide to everyone. And, you know, it's just not what you would expect it in, you know, in a case where your father was murdered. You would expect that the sheriff's department is going to be there for you, and that's going to, you know, answer all questions. But I don't even know what the scope of the investigation was, you know, because I had to placate them. You know, I could not show that I was angry. I could not show that I didn't trust them because that would have been sought as, you know, possibly in the public eye as me not being credible. So I had to placate what was going on and not push. And I had to rely on others in the media and stuff to do the pushing that I couldn't. But here, we're 2 years later, so we're 2 years under this investigation that Zanke has. And since that email, I haven't heard boo from him, other than the fact that he's running for sheriff. So now I think I'm in a position to where I can be more critical. You know, what is the scope of the investigation? Who are you still going after? When are we going to go after them? What are we expecting? Are you ever going to have ask what happened back in 1981 in the sheriff's office? So I think that we can probably, you know, start asking those questions. And, you know, I can become very visible in 2014. And if that case is not closed by then, I will. You know, he'll run against the actual opponent for sheriff, and he'll run against me. And I can't lose because I don't expect to be sheriff. So, but that's what will happen. Yeah, I'm about ready. You know, like I said, the book was to honor my father. Well, we started to write it too soon for that. So now it's going to become a tool. It's going to become an invitation to come to my website when I launch it and to follow what's going on from there forward. I expect that I'm going to start, you know, contacting Zanke on a regular basis for updates on the case. I'm also planning on writing individuals that publicly support Andrew Zanke. I'm going to send them letters and ask them to reply back, and I'm going to post this. I've gotten a lot of practice out of my last campaign, and I expect to utilize everything that I've learned and bring it to them. I think the case needs to be closed. If they don't want to ask what happened back in 1981, close it so I can ask what happened back in 1981. If I find anything worthwhile, I'll bring it back to them. If not, I walk away with a full understanding of what happened to my father.
Keith, I'd like to bring you in for a minute here from an author's perspective. You have the unique position of being a retired police officer turned author. So, since you've been involved with the research and researching to do to put the book together, what has been your experience or thoughts on this? Are you do you have concerns yourself about the way McHenry County has cooperated or failed to cooperate with the efforts for research?
Definitely, Denny. I mean, when, you know, I came into this from a cop's perspective. I read the exceptional clearance or exceptional status letter and said, well, cases are sometimes written up that way, but it still left a lot to be desired. There was a lot of information missing from it. And then when I sent in for the Freedom of Information request, I put in there that we were doing a book, that I was a retired police officer. I wanted to make sure they got a fair shot on it. And nope, we're protecting witnesses. My idea was, Frank is our witness to this. He was, you know, he's the one who told the story 2,000 miles away. And there was another person mentioned. That other person is talking to Paul. They talk on the telephone. So if those two people are witnesses, we already know who they are. We're not hurting them.
Yeah, let's talk about that second person. That second person that Keith is referring to is a man named Tommy Amata. Tommy Amata, supposedly, you know, well, not even supposedly, there was an affidavit back in 1981, 82, somewhere right there, Frank had a case that he was going to court with, Tommy was going to take the fall for it. This is some stolen furniture that they found in Frank's house, and Tommy was going to take the fall for that because three strikes and Frank's a career criminal. Right. Tommy, he's a young guy, and as far as I know, I don't think he had anything on him. So Frank sent him back to Chicago with Larry because Larry was going to go ahead and do a burglary. And Frank also thought that, you know, having Tommy with him might keep him on ice a little bit as far as going after my father. Well, supposedly Tommy wound up driving Larry to the bar. And he heard some gunshots. Then he heard two more gunshots. Larry hops in the car, disassembled the weapon, and then they threw it in one of the lakes or rivers up in McHenry County going over a bridge. Tommy Amata would be complicit in
this. I bet it's a big headache, but I bet you were good at it.
Oh, excuse me, we're getting some feedback. Okay, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, here's a couple things. One, Tommy Amata, he denies that affidavit. He felt like he was being put on the spot between Frank and Detective Dave Grover in trying to collaborate things. The bottom line is when we first started all this stuff, when we found out, the McHenry County Sheriff wasn't contacted right away. We felt like our ace in the hole was to go ahead and reach out to Tommy and to find out, you know, what had happened and see if maybe we could get immunity for his testimony or something to that effect. You know, so, I had to talk to my mom. You know, I said, you know, Mom, this is what's going on. You know, I'm thinking we have to reach out to this Tommy Amata guy. And at that time, I felt like he was the one that drove Larry. You know, I'm like, how do you feel about this? I know how I feel about this, but how do you feel about this? She's like, well, what was he going to do? Get himself killed? And she was right on the money. She had this right. What was Tommy Amata supposed to do? His civic duty? Go to the McHenry County Sheriff? Hey, I was with the murderer? He would have been whacked. He would have been killed for sure. You know, he wasn't even in a position to do his civil duty. And quite frankly, from my perspective, my mom's perspective, my family's perspective, we don't care whether he was there or not. If he was there, we understand why he wouldn't say anything. Larry Newman for sure would have killed him. He'd gone to the cops. He would have got killed that way. I mean, he was in a lose-lose situation. So to persecute or to go after Tommy in this, it would be an absolute miscarriage of justice. So it's Debbie and it's Tommy. These are the only people that are complicit or are thought to be complicit. And in my belief, if you can't go after Tommy until you look into that sheriff's office first, if that sheriff's office is found to be complicit, you can't be blaming Tommy. And Debbie Newman, she said what she said already. I highly doubt that she's going to call anybody back and say, hey, I wasn't being truthful with you guys. I'm the one that caused this whole mess. So close the case. And if anybody pops up out of the woodwork, it's a murder case. You know, there's no time frame on a murder case. That can be reopened or looked into any time and always. So, you know, those are my thoughts about that.
You know, let me say this. And yes.
if you remember, Denny, when you and Frank were doing a presentation here in Las Vegas, I stood up and I asked Frank, why did McHenry take you seriously? And he said, because they were mobbed up.
Yeah.
That's quite a statement to come out of someone.
I remember that very well, and I think, and we mentioned this earlier in the show tonight, that that perhaps at least back in this Hendel guy and back in the 1981 the time of the murders may very well have been under the control or in the pocket of the outfit. I would not doubt that a bit. And
I'm sorry, Denny. It's just that the outfit was definitely, they were still strong back then. They definitely had ties in McHenry County, for the gambling, the prostitution. The outfit was still strong at that time.
And it seems to me that, Keith, and I'll run this by you, but on the other show I do with Crime Wire, we run into on a regular basis police agencies that say they can't have someone come on the show as a guest to discuss it because it's an open case and they don't want to divulge anything. We've had them turn down record requests to the family, to the victim's family, because they say it's an open case and so on. And, you know, the majority of the time, there are undoubtedly real legitimate reasons to keep the information confidential. They certainly don't want to blow an investigation by divulging something prematurely, and I understand that, and we as hosts of the show don't want them to do that either. However, I found, and I'm a pro law enforcement guy, but I found, and I've heard from other former law people, that same reasoning, that same logic of saying we can't divulge it now, it's an open case, we don't want to do anything that would screw the case up, can also be used to conceal incompetence.
Yeah,
conceal
yeah.
less than adequate investigation. So it's a two-edged sword. While maybe in the majority of cases there's a legitimate reason that's also out there, and if they got something that might embarrass the department or worse, they got that to hang their hat on. As long as they can keep that as an open investigation, they can bypass the freedom of information statutes in the individual states and hang their hat on that it's an open murder case, and therefore they can't release any information. And, you know, I don't know. I've never dealt directly with McHenry County. I don't know what's in their files, but it almost sounds that way here.
Well, they said that Hendel was known for keeping information very close to the vest, not keeping notes and logs, things like that. And then there's another case that comes out of there where the supposed bad guy killed his parents. He didn't help himself with the way he ran his mouth at the scene, I will say that. But it turned out two bikers from Wisconsin killed his parents. He was put away by McHenry County. One of the lead investigators was Detective Sergeant Beverly Hendel. Sound familiar?
Yeah. We're talking about a legacy sheriff. You know, this George Hendel is not the first Hendel to become sheriff. There's somebody in his bloodline, I don't know who, father or grandfather, who's also sheriff. You know, what does that sound like? You know, legacy sheriffs. Sounds a little mobbed up to me. And, go ahead, Denny.
I was just going to say, sometimes you hear it, you generally associate this with the old stereotype Southern Sheriff's Department, but you hear the Good Old Boys Network.
Right.
Where people are connected, they know each other, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, even though this obviously isn't a Southern state or Southern county, you could almost get that good old boy feel of, you know, I got to tell Keith, as a cop, I've worked for various agencies in my life, state, village, county, and I never worked at a place where the policy was, don't write anything down. don't leave any record. It was exactly the opposite. If you could end up losing your job if you didn't document what you did and had something in a case file, and heaven forbid, if you went out on patrol and got shot that night or something and were no longer there, whoever got that case next had to be able to look through that file and try to figure out what the hell had happened and where the case stood. So this deal, when you start hearing these agencies talk about, well, you know, they did the job, they just didn't keep any records. I say bullshit to that.
Yeah. It's kind of scary with that.
Well, and there were some other issues too. You know, they lost my parents' guns. You know, I'm a former Marine. That is really hard for me to handle. We account for every round, you know, and there's almost a couple hundred thousand of us, you know, and to lose two guns, you know, and how many guns are you keeping in your safe over there? Because, you know, at that time, you know, McHenry County was small, and I'm quite confident that there wasn't a murder for like 20 years prior to that in the entire McHenry County. You know, and let's not keep notes. It's what, only a double homicide, right? It doesn't make any sense.
Not like losing a parking ticket or something.
No, I could see if the guns were destroyed. It's, you know, nobody claimed them after so many years, they're destroyed. But then again, there should be a record that these guns
were
destroyed. There has to be a paper trail somewhere. And there's no paper trail, or it's not made available. When one of Jim Hager's daughters called up McHenry County Sheriff's Department and said, "You have any unsolved homicides?" They told her no. She says, "Well, you better go check your records." And they called her back and said, "Yeah, we have one. How did you know?"
Yeah, that's true.
Andrew, what do you think about this? Are you
pretty much you got to think of it this way. When you're in doubt, there is no doubt. I mean, as far as this goes, I mean, I've never been on a court case where they lost my paperwork. I mean, they've always had paperwork. If the paperwork, I mean, it's definitely suspect what's going on there. It's definitely suspect. And, you know, when you think about these things, there's nothing more dangerous. I can tell you this right now. I, you know, for years, you know, I was always, I would run away from law enforcement every chance I'd get. But after I became a witness and I started to meet guys on a personal level and started to become social with FBI agents, this one and that one, in my dealings, you know, you realize that, you know, these guys, a lot of them have strong integrity. And you don't see that following what's happening with your case. There's nothing stipulating that anybody who's doing this investigation is really coming clean, either one, to save their own selves from an open investigation so he could become sheriff, or two, protecting somebody else who is very close to them in this very, very small community. And nobody wants to be the one to say that they had this information and they knew where to go with it, and they never did for whatever reason it is. And the only way, I hate to say it, but the only way that I could see this ever getting real results is if the government had a hand in trying to get this information. And being that it's not a federal case, I don't see it. I think, if it would have been a federal case, if Frank was called to be a witness, it would have been a federal case. But being it didn't go no further than the open investigation, they're not going to get that kind of exposure under the microscope that they needed to get to the real bottom of this. You know, so it's going to be very hard unless you get to close that case. It really is. From what my perspective, from seeing it how that is, because usually that comes from the federal level to get those kind of answers at this point.
I'm going to have to concur with Andrew on this. I mean, this has definitely been an uphill battle. I mean, and it felt like, you know, in the last campaign, you know, first, why am I campaigning? That would be the first obvious question, I would think. But, you know, it's necessary to go ahead and get these things done. It's an uphill battle. This stuff is not easy. And that's why, you know, really, we got a lot of stuff done, though, by people paying attention, keeping this in people's eyes, and it did put pressure on them. Now, Now we've got something that he wants. He wants votes. He wants votes to become sheriff. He needs me to go away for that, I think. And I'll happily go away. I mean, currently, I'm not, you know, I call McHenry my home. If anybody, you know, hey, I'm going home, they know what I mean. They know I'm going back to McHenry. I'm leaving Texas. But for me going back there right now, you know, I don't think it's comfortable for me or any other sheriff to go back there. You know, we see how things are treated. And, you know, quite honestly, this murder case was fairly easy at this point. You know, we had all the answers. And so to go ahead and be hiding behind it and stuff like that is bizarre to me. But we're in a position, though, I think that we can play pressure, put pressure on them. And like I said, you know, right now I got business with McHenry. So I'm going to be very involved in trying to get my business done. Close the case, I got no business with you no more. I have to go away, and I have to respect that I'm not currently in that community. Let the community vote as they see fit. But as long as I got business up there, I'm going to have to push my initiative. And then that includes not him being sheriff.
Paul, do they know, does Zanke or McHenry County know you're writing this book?
No. They may now, but I at this point, no. I haven't contacted them. I'm just getting my ducks in a row. You know, and like I said, the book was to honor my father. Too early for that. So now it's a tool. And so I'm going to have to get my other ducks in a row, get the website up and running, and we're going to campaign. We're going to make a lot of public awareness. We'll try to keep things interesting, you know, building up to the campaign. They close the case, I'm done. I'm out of there. You know, I'm on to my own thing. But as long as that case stays open, then I feel compelled to see if possibly there's any candidates that's going to run up against them that have a better understanding of justice than what Andrew Zanke is. And I'm not ready to support anybody, especially being in McHenry County. I think you got to look at that carefully. I don't want to change one devil for another. But I'm definitely going to be speaking out about the devil I know. And this is not the man that you want to be your sheriff. It will be bad news if you find yourself in a tragic situation. And quite honestly, I don't believe a sheriff can go back to McHenry right now and feel safe. There's definitely bitterness. I mean, one of the reasons why Keith filed for the Freedom of Information Act, because we thought it would be better than me. I mean, for whatever reason, they don't like me. And we thought, hey, you know, Keith's the cop. Go do the cop thing. Go be buddies, get the file, and, you know, let's get on with it. But that, it was a very sharp, closed-down thing that happened as far as their response. And it's really for ridiculous reasons. I mean, I know all the major witnesses. I'm friends with all the major witnesses. None of them are afraid of anything at the moment. There's nothing to be afraid of. The only major witness that I don't know is Debbie Newman. And we all feel pretty comfortable on who she is and where she fits in all this stuff.
And we can't find her right now.
Well, yeah, I don't know where she's at. You know, I'm inclined to think that, you know, that she was in Kentucky, because I believe that that's where they went out to speak to her. But I don't know where she was at, what she was doing or anything like that. You know, but if you didn't get her, catching her off guard, saying, hey, 27 years ago, what were you doing? And if you didn't feel like there was enough there to move forward, you got nothing to move forward with. So she's kind of a dead-end issue. But if she pops up, don't worry. I'm sure we can file charges. Nobody's going to object. Pursuing Tommy, miscarriage of justice, just wrong. So just close the case. You don't care about what happened back in 1981. Close the case. But you hit it right, Jenny. The reason why they did it is to go ahead and hide bad police.
Now, Paul, is the rest of your family supportive of the book project you're working on? And how about the Pat Freeman's family? Are they... do they know you're writing the book?
Yeah. My family's very supportive of it. You know, I think they, too, feel that, you know, it's important to kind of solidify this story because, one, it's our story. Two, it's important to the community. So they have appreciation for that. I actually got done talking to Paula on the phone yesterday, and the Freemans don't feel the same way, you know, as that. They kind of see the book as, you know, entertainment. And certainly losing their mother isn't entertaining. And I respect how they feel about that. You know, and I just hope they respect my feelings on this, that, you know, this is my story too. And I feel very, you know, strongly that it needs to be told. And, you know, whether we like it or not, the fact that it had all this circus around it is what made people pay attention. And that is the biggest thing that we used. It was people that made changes. It was people that helped drive the exceptional status, naming Larry Newman as the murderer of my father and their mother. So I think the thing that they weren't anticipating is that there was still more work to do. They believed that the case was closed as well. So...
Now, what do you guys see as the time frame with the book? Now, where do you stand with the manuscript of the book as of today?
Well, we're reorganizing it and getting everything in the proper place in the book, then turn it over to an editor, and then we're looking for a publisher.
Yeah.
We've discussed it with some already who have an interest. In fact, we have one out in Illinois that is interested, which I thought would make a great local release.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think we'll be wrapping this up here shortly. We, you know, all the content is there. There's just a couple of things that we need to streamline to get it right in the timeline of the way things happen. And then, like he said, off to the editor and off to the publisher.
So are you figuring to have that piece of it done, and even if it's not physically out in print, at least have it, you know, edited and find a publisher by the end of the year?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah. Whatever Keith said, I'm a first-time author. I'll let Keith answer that one.
Yeah, we'll be done before the end of the year, Denny.
Oh, good, good. That's now... The other thing, when the book comes out, Paul, are you thinking about maybe having, you know, maybe somebody from the Chicago newspapers, the McHenry County paper, or TV folks in the area read it to, you know, maybe take an interest in the story and what you think happened and what you've gone through?
Oh, absolutely. I made a lot of friends along the way. And I'll be contacting everybody, and a couple of them should be really interested in the fact that the case is not closed because they've been kind of hoodwinked too. Like I said, this was on the cover of the Chicago Sun-Times. I believe it was the Sunday edition, and it was in the Northwest Herald, you know. So if they appreciate credibility and integrity like I do, well, they weren't straight with you. So I plan on contacting everybody and getting out there, and you know, and every time somebody wants to interview me about my book, I'll be talking about Under Sheriff Andrew Zanke.
I just don't think we're going to have a book release party in McHenry.
No. If we do, we're going to have to boogie right on to Lake County really quick.
Danny, know what I'm thinking about their book real quick? I'm thinking about the book coming out will pretty much set a standard, because being they can't get the answers and the closure that they're looking for in this situation by the police department in this county not coming forward for what they know, it automatically puts a black eye on that law enforcement community. So once this book is written, they're going to have a black eye forever, because if they were on the up and up back then and they were doing real good police work then, you know, people are never going to know. All people are going to see now is what they didn't do. How come they didn't answer? What they're doing, they're shooting themselves in the foot, actually, by not coming forward with this information. Because people are never going to... If you read the book and you live in that area, people ain't going to trust them any longer.
Well,
you're right.
You're underestimating the arrogance of McHenry County Sheriff's Office. They've been in the national spotlight, never in a favorable moment. You know, and Keith told a story about sending the guy to death row for murdering his parents that he didn't do. And the appellate court let him out, and then they had the DA still calling him a murderer and everything else. They don't back down for nothing. They're one of the fiercest. I mean, I know them personally, but I, from my perception, they're one of the fiercest sheriff's department I think there's out there.
Guys, we just ran out of time. We're getting cut off the air here, so we're going to have to wrap it up. But I hope you'll come back on and, you know, let us know when the book comes out. We'll have you back on again, and we'll do round two.
That would be great.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
You guys have a good night. It was great to speak to you, Paul. It was really great to speak to you guys.
Take care.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Andrew.
All right, you guys have a good night.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. Please join us again on August 15th for another installment of We Know a Guy Radio. And don't forget to check out BearMediaConsultants.com, the place to go if you want to get connected. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. Good night, Andrew. Good night, Kim.
Good night, Dennis. Peace out, brother. Bye.
Bye-bye.